Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Patrick, are you a big Elvis fan?
Yeah, I mean, I like the Sun Records stuff, and of course his 1970 masterwork.
1970? I don't think I know that one.
Yeah, you know, Jim, the stuff he did with Nixon.
Oh, Patrick, it was such a joy to talk to Peter Gralnick again. We met him a few years ago on the old show, as we mentioned yesterday. And, you know, this is a guy who has such a deep appreciation and understanding for American roots music. And this new book that he has out, Looking to Get Lost, really covers, you know, a career in that area. And you know, huge people he's talked to: Ray Charles, Chuck Berry, Johnny Cash, you know, James Brown, right? It's just it's amazing the people he has known and really, I think, gotten to know. And I think that's the important thing here too. It's not just like you or I, you know, sitting down and doing a 45-minute interview with somebody. He really spent time with these people and really got to know them and as much as possible, like, understand their perspective and sort of what drove them to create such, you know, incredible music and art that has lasted and will continue to last, you know, for decades. So,
yeah. And I think if you enjoyed this interview, you'll really like the book because of, you know, what you said, Jim, and he gives his thought process on why he would approach these interviews that way. And if you've read his other stuff, it just, goes a little deeper. You know, it's kind of like a cool, compilation of you know, odds and ends and things like that too. So it works both ways as a great book on American music, and also if you're a fan of Gralnick, it's really cool insight into his thought process, approach, and recounting some of the stories of these interviews and conversations.
That's right. Okay, so our show is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan,
and I'm Patrick Foster.
And if you didn't listen to part one of the interview with Peter Gralnick, you should go do that.
Yep.
Don't come in midway.
Nope.
Go back and see the first half of the movie. And now, here is part two.
All you big and burly men who roll the trucks along, better listen, you'll be thankful when you hear my song. You have really got it made if you're hauling goods any place on earth but those Haynesville woods. It's a stretch of road up north in Maine that's never, ever, ever seen a smile. If they buried all the truckers lost in them woods, there'd be a tombstone every mile. Count 'em off, there'd be a tombstone every mile.
Peter, you write, art is always there to be found. It's up to us to open our eyes and ears. Even now, there is some contemporary Robert Johnson, some painter, some poet, some unacknowledged novelist, performance artist, musician waiting to be discovered. And if we are fortunate enough to make that discovery, we are uplifted by it. But our presence in the room makes not the slightest difference to the vitality of the work. I love that. And I wonder if you could give us a little bit of an insight into why you feel that way.
Isn't that in the chapter on Robert Johnson?
That's right, yeah. And the other thing I'll say about that really quick for our folks is one reason to buy this book is to really understand why you should use the word awesome. And I won't go any farther than that. There's a part in that chapter that really defines the word awesome.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that. So,
well, I think that was prompted. I mean, I know it was prompted by what I see as the arrogance of the critic, of the audience, of the listener, of the reader, to applaud themselves for having discovered this wonderful work. It could be Henry Green. I mean, boy, Peter, you deserve great credit for bringing attention to Henry Green. I don't deserve any credit. You know, thank God for Henry Green. I mean, there he is waiting to be discovered by successive generations. And the same with Robert Johnson. So I feel like there's a kind of misunderstanding, and maybe I'm guilty of the same thing. You know, it's like I write about Dick Curlis in this new book.
Yeah.
And to me, he's an artist of such profundity and talent and reach and scope. And he's not as well known as many of the people I'm writing about. But I'm not looking for any credit writing about him. I want to bring people to him as much as I wanted to bring people to James Brown when I first started writing, you know, who was certainly better known. But the point is, it's the focus should be on the work itself. And I think that's one of the reasons that, to me, I never wanted to be a critic. I may have written what could be called criticism, but I feel like so often as a critic, you're tempted to call attention to yourself. It could be by the style with which you describe something. You do a lot of showing off and you say, look at me, look at me, look at me. And I'm saying, look at this.
Right.
Listen to this.
Right.
And so that's really what it is, you know, for me. And I wrote the Robert Johnson really in response to the idea that people had singled him out as the blues singer in the same way that, you know, we were talking about Solomon Burke. And my only point was, yes, this is supernal art. But recently there's been kind of a revisionist history of sorts, which says, well, you know, all these blues singers from the Mississippi Delta, Robert Johnson wasn't that important because he wasn't selling that many records. Well, that's weird to me because his music, his songs were carried on because the songs had such impact, such power in the careers of people like Elmore James or Robert Jr. Lockwood, who had real careers. Muddy Waters. Muddy Waters was inspired by the song and continued to record the song. It wasn't because some white critic was telling them, oh, you should pay attention to this because this is the pinnacle of the blues. It was because the music had such impact. And that's what I try to call attention to.
One of the things you wrote in there, which I found interesting and you just sort of alluded to, was that idea that you didn't really want to be a music critic, but you wanted to tell the stories of these people and give their life and connection to music and, I think more importantly, creativity, give it some context, right? So what I wanted to ask was, what have you learned in all these years of being a journalist, talking with the types of people you have and profiling them? What have you learned about creativity? If that's not a big enough question for you, I can ask a bigger one, right?
That's a global, you know, if it's the opposite of a pan, it's a pan something, not pandemic. Right, but I to respond to the first part of your question, I wanted to be an advocate for music and for musicians and for artists too, for writers that I was passionate about. I never wrote about somebody that I didn't like. I never took an assignment to write something that I wasn't enthusiastic about or more than enthusiastic, awesomely enthusiastic. So all of these were stories and people to whom I was committed. But it took me a while to recognize that the best way I had of describing the depth and dimension of the music, what the music meant to me, was really through the profile. I'm not a musician. And if I were, I wouldn't want to analyze, you know, how they threw in the G seventh minor chord here, or, you know, do you get this passing note here? That's not what I want. I want the feeling. I want to get at the feeling. And the way that I found was to write about the people and what the music or what the writing meant to them. But as far as the creativity, what I realized as I worked on it was those are the questions that I asked every single person. It wasn't like I formulated some theory of interviewing, but even, you know, in talking to Skip James in 1965, I'm asking him, what motivated you? What were you trying to express? Right. What is coming out? And all the way through, whether, I mean, it's much more explicit later on when I'm talking to Alan Toussaint and Elvis Costello,
right?
Because they collaborated on, you know, on that album, River in Reverse.
Yep.
I'm asking Alan Toussaint, the great songwriter, great musician, if you were to write a song for Elvis, what would you write? And same with Elvis, you know. To me, it was really fascinating, sort of here you have a collaboration in creativity. It was really fascinating to explore both the differences and the ways in which they came together. But finally, when I was writing, I think, the prologue, one of the things I realized about all the people I'd written about, I felt that they all had two things in common. One was a work ethic, which is not always recognized. And when people think of somebody like Jerry Lee Lewis, they're likely to describe him in the way that some people might describe NBA star, you know, a great natural talent.
Yeah.
There's a genius to what they do. They may not be able to articulate it in terms that would get them a Harvard MBA, but what they achieve is not achieved by accident. It's achieved by hard work, by application and development of their skills. And there isn't a single person I wrote about who didn't take themselves or their art seriously. There's no one who worked harder at his music than Jerry Lee Lewis, regardless of what his public persona is. And the other thing that really struck me was the extent to which they all shared a democratic vision, because none of the musicians thought for a moment about category, but vision. They had what Sam Phillips called ears all around their head.
Yeah.
And they were listening to everything, and they were equally open. You know, maybe some of them did not have the most progressive politics in the world, and yet they were open to every type of music. There was no differentiation between black and white, and that goes both ways. Somebody like Charlie Feathers would cite Junior Kimbrough as being the greatest musician. You grew up with him in Holly Springs, Mississippi.
I so appreciate what you were saying, Peter, about those varied influences of a lot of great musicians, because, you know, when I was a kid buying, you know, just starting out sort of buying records and listening to, you know, FM radio and things like that, mm-hmm. in my mind, I would think, well, if you're in like a heavy metal band, you only listen to heavy metal music, right? And if you're, a pop star, then you only listen to dance music or club music or whatever. And then it was only, you know, when I got older and started to interview some of these people that you come to realize, like, they have incredible curiosity. They want to know about it all. They want to know how it's all put together, right? And I think that I think that curiosity drives a lot of creativity as well.
Oh, totally. And you know, it's like the chapter on Ray Charles is about the evolution of I Got a Woman,
yep.
and its impact and its influence and how it established finally a path for Ray Charles to establish a career and a musical way of expression of his own.
Well, I got a woman way over town that's good to me. Oh, yeah. Say, I got a woman way over town.
I spent about a week with him out in L.A. at his recording studio. He was working on an album. And at one point I asked him, I don't know if this is the book or not, but I asked him, so what do you listen to? You know, what are you listening to? And he says, oh, man, I love those Jackie Gleason Presents albums. And, you know, and I thought he was putting me on. You know, this is how, I mean, believe me, I had such a narrow view, in a sense, when I started out. I mean, it was like Elvis was this kind of a singer. In later years, I've come to appreciate almost more than anything I can cite his recordings from 60, 61, 62, his beautiful ballad recordings, mm-hmm. which he just brought so much to, discipline to, and feeling, and control, and freedom. But so Ray Charles says, Jackie Gleason Presents. And I wasn't going to say...
I got one right here.
There we go. Patrick's showing it on the video right now. Music, Martinis, and Memories.
Martinis, and Memories. There's Jackie Gleason. Yep.
Well, anyway, so I hung in there at least, you know, and I mean, I wasn't going to commit myself too much and make even more of a fool of myself than I thought I was already making. And he says, yeah, man, Bobby Hackett trumpet. You know, there's just nothing sweeter than Bobby Hackett's trumpet. Huh. And I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe I can't say that I went out and got a lot of Jackie Gleason Presents. But with Elvis, for example, who as a kid, I was determined to think of as a blues singer who was led astray by commercial enterprises or something to record other things than blues, which of course was about 90% of the time. But every time he recorded anything other than blues, they say, oh, they made him do it.
Right.
It wasn't until years later that I realized, I mean, when I was working on the biography, same with Sam Cooke, they wanted to appeal to everybody and they heard every type of music in their head and they wanted to incorporate it all, you know, not pull it in by the hair or anything, but be able to incorporate it naturally into their own music.
Right.
Amazing. And Peter, I want to ask you, your writing style to me has never really changed that much. And I think that's one of the highest compliments. I mean, you wrote in a style that was meant for you to get the feeling of why you were writing about whatever you were writing about, right? You mm-hmm. sort of made it, I don't want to say plain, and I'm not even really sure what word is right here, but your style is, you know, just really lets the subject live and breathe. And I wonder, did you consciously have to pull yourself back to stay in that style, or did you always kind of write like that, or did you always know before you went in, you know, this is how I'm going to do it?
Well, you know, I wanted it to reflect the dignity and show the respect that I had for the people I was writing about.
Which totally comes through, of course, yeah.
So I wanted it to be colloquial but not be limited to the language of a particular time or place.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think I've refined that to a degree over the years, but that was really my original intention. So that rather than write in sort of a gonzo style or something yeah. like that, that was the fundamental commitment I made. I think that I've always tried to do something different. So that, for instance, I wrote the first two books were collections of profiles.
Yep.
And when I started Sweet Soul Music, the idea was I'm going to do another collection of profiles, and it'll be Solomon Burke. And you can see Solomon Burke is a profile in Sweet Soul Music. But the Joe Tex that is in the new book was not in Sweet Soul Music because it exists as in a separate way as a profile
right.
in Looking to Get Lost. So I wanted to do something different. So I did a narrative history. And then in the Elvis in particular, the two volumes, I made a rigorous commitment to keep myself out of it completely.
Yeah.
You can find me in Sweet Soul Music. You won't find me in Last Train to Memphis or Careless Love. But then when I did the Sam Phillips, for example, because I had known Sam for so long, I wrote in a very different style and tried to make it more of a free-flowing, because I was writing about something. He had 10 years of intense creativity, Sam Phillips did.
Right, right.
Starting with the Ike Turner and Howlin' Wolf and going, you know, through to Charlie Rich, let's say.
Right.
And then he wasn't in music much anymore.
Yeah.
But to me, he was one of the most amazing people and one of the most original thinkers. And so I wanted to make the whole book entertaining. And because I was present at so many moments, I tried to do a much more free-flowing narrative. And then in Looking to Get Lost, I took some of that style of the Sam Phillips and tried to, again, to tell the story in a more informal and free-flowing way than I might have when I started out writing. But I would say you're right. There is a consistency to it. And at the core is just that respect for the artist, for their work. And, you know, that's what I tried to maintain.
Beautifully said, Peter. And I want to say, one, thank you so much for writing this book, because it, like you said, it's a different angle on your vision, and you've exposed me to so many different artists. So thank you for doing that. And also, the highest kudos, the way you've written and kept your writing style focused through every book is truly awesome. So it really is. It really is.
Okay, and then the last thing I have is this. I can't remember what year you said this was, but you, I guess, had a moment where you were reflecting on, did you want to keep doing this mm-hmm. anymore? Mm-hmm. And this mm-hmm. is the part I want to read. It says, it would be nice to sit back and listen to the music again without a notebook always poised, or the next interviewing question always in the back of your mind.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you still feel that way, or did you feel that way later on? Are there times when you think no. to yourself, I would like to just listen to the music for the music, no?
Well, I listen to the music for the music. I mean, not too long ago, I was listening to Merle Haggard, drove two stops beyond my exit. So.
All right.
But, well, I mean, I was serious about that, and this was sort of the epilogue to Feel Like Going Home in 1971. And I didn't write anything about music for 3 years after that.
Mm-hmm.
Then a guy named Jim Miller, who edited the Rolling Stone Illustrated History of Rock and Roll,
yeah.
was a professor at the New School in politics, I believe. He was the music editor of the real paper then. And he said, you know, Waylon Jennings is coming to town, and I think that would be a great person for you to write about. And I hadn't listened to a lot of Waylon Jennings. It was not long after Honky Tonk Heroes came out. You know, at Jim's prodding, I started listening to Waylon Jennings. And I just was totally knocked out. And I thought, man, this is the blues. You know, I mean, it was yeah. the same feeling. It was the same impact. It was the same, you know. And so he was performing at this club for a week. And I went every night and I interviewed him. And I was lured back and just sucked back in. And there was one moment where I had been teaching part-time for all those years, because you need something to, you know, help support the writing. And that job ran out. And at that time, I thought, man, I should get something else to help support the writing. And I set up an interview. And so we talked, and it was very nice and everything. And then I went back down to the Sugar Shack, this den of iniquity, you know, the Soul Club in Boston. And I hung around after the show was over, and Bobby's band leader, Mel Jackson, had called a horn rehearsal, which never happened because either one or two of the, and everybody got, there was a big argument, one or two of the horns didn't show up. And I left, you know, dragged myself into the, I mean, it was just inhabited at that point by denizens of the night, the club. And but I had this moment of revelation where all of a sudden I realized I'd rather spend the rest of my life sitting around in the Sugar Shack with the glitter still up from Christmas and, you know, and all this kind of bedraggled glory and real glory too. I'd rather spend the rest of my life, you know, sitting around the sugar shack waiting for a horn rehearsal that never happens, then teach English in some high class, you know, and so that was it. Yeah. After that, I really never looked back.
Amazing. A couple things I want to say to everybody as we wrap up here, maybe three things. One reason to get this book is the story Peter relates, or that Tammy Wynette tells, about putting herself to sleep every night with a Hank Williams record. Anyone who owns a record player will love this story about how she sort of fell asleep with her arm in a certain position so she could put the 45 back on until she fell asleep. Totally amazing. And, right. You know, no care for the vinyl, just got to hear the music. And two, read Nighthawk Blues if you're a fan of Peter's work. I mean, it's an original novel that's just really, really fantastic. And still in print, as far as I know. And lastly, Peter, you know, just really quick off the top of your head, if no one in our community, and our community is weirdly starting to grow worldwide, if no one's, you know, read any of your stuff about American music, where would you recommend they start?
Gee, I don't know. I mean, I you know, this is like asking somebody to choose between their kids. I really couldn't. I mean, the Last Train to Memphis, the first volume of the Elvis, is so completely different from Careless Love, the second volume of the Elvis biography. And the Sam Cooke, in a way, is a summation of so much that I've always, you know, felt, tried to write about the community, about Black community, about striving, about just a whole range, about how the capitalist system is rigged, you know, all kinds of things. Those are all, you know, subtext. They're not explored directly, and yet they are, in a way. Total. So I don't know. I mean, right now I'm most enthusiastic about Looking to Get Lost because it was, it was just a thrill to write. And I'm just so glad to have, you know, if you think about it, I'm glad that it's out there making its own way in the world.
Yeah.
And that to me is, you write something and you want to put it out there and people may have different reactions to it. But the main thing is the book will stand on its own. And that's really all that matters.
And it's been a pleasure, Peter. Thank you for your time.
Now, listen, I've really enjoyed it. Even if we couldn't do it in person, I've enjoyed it almost as much as our actual meeting in Washington, D.C. You know.
That was great. And you can send me as many autographed books as you want.
All right. Well, I would tell people, check out Looking to Get Lost, because I think it's a great sort of overview of Peter's work, but also, just as I mentioned, it's a great look at American music and what that is. And you get everyone from some of the giants, like we mentioned, Johnny Cash and Chuck Berry, down to some people you've probably never heard of, but are not less important. So,
yeah, it's not too late to get a belated Christmas gift.
There you go. All right, Peter Gronlich, thank you very much for spending so much time with us. We really do appreciate it.
Oh, thanks. It's really been fun.
Oh, thanks, Peter.
It's been great.
Oh, she's my baby. Don't you understand? Yeah, I'm a lover man. I got a woman way over town that's good to me. Oh, yeah. Don't you know she's all right? Don't you know she's all right? She's all right, she's all right.
Okay, and our thanks again to Peter Gralnick. Thanks very much for spending so much time with us. And for everyone out there, check out the book, Looking to Get Lost. It's a great read. And it's divided up into chapters where you can sort of like, you know, hunt around if you want to, you know. So if it's like, hey, that's really interested in the Johnny Cash stuff, you can read that first and then, you know, read about, you know, some of the artists maybe that are new to you. So it's a great book to have around the house.
It really is, Jim. And I'll say briefly that I want to thank Peter a lot, too. You know, it's just from the pure thrill of being able to speak to one of your favorite authors of all time and somebody who, you know, was able to make a living and dedicate his life to doing something that just seems so enjoyable and pleasurable to someone like myself who loves to, you know, get into the weeds and learn about all the little details. I mean, Peter studied Elvis so closely that he compiled basically a log of everything Elvis did every day. You know, by the time he released that first album, first single, through the end of his life, he had a record of what Elvis did every single day.
Yeah.
And that's pretty deep research.
Right.
And it's fascinating to me. So I think it's really, really cool.
I love the stuff too, where in our interview where we talked about Solomon Burke. I think that's somebody, if you don't know his work, you really should. And it's to me, it's kind of a crime that he's not better known, that he's not up there with, you know, with those legends.
so
the way
man.
He should be. So anyway, okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Starting tomorrow, we're going to do the Best of 2020 series. It's a series.
Yeah. Exciting.
That we do every year. Not 2020, but you get the idea. Looking back yep. at the previous year. And you're going to hear listeners talk about their favorite music from the past year. A year in which I think music helped get a lot of people through these tough times. So
yeah, sure did.
Okay. All right. And with that, it's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
It's a stretch of road up north in Maine that's never, ever, ever seen a smile. If they buried all the truckers lost in them woods, there'd be a tombstone every mile. Count them all, there'd be a tombstone every mile.
I was listening to Merle Haggard, drove two stops beyond my exit.